This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to the origins of an enduring political myth, the Muslim no-go zone, referred to not for the first time by Steve Emerson, terrorist analyst for Fox News.
In Britain, it's not just no-go zones. There are actual cities like Birmingham that are totally Muslim, where non-Muslims just simply don't go in.
And that was followed swiftly by the somewhat restrained ire of British Prime Minister David Cameron.
When I heard this, frankly, I choked on my porridge and I thought it must be April Fool's Day. This guy is clearly a complete idiot.
Then came a series of on-air apologies, pretty uncharacteristic for the Fox network.
Over the course of this last week, we have made some regrettable errors on air.
We apologize.
We apologize.
We apologize.
We deeply regret these errors and apologize to the people of Birmingham, our viewers, and all who've been offended.
Well, the mayor of Paris, for one, was not appeased and announced that the city would sue Fox for a similar slur. Still, the notion that certain urban zones have become no-go areas for non-Muslims persists. It's even gaining momentum in some circles. David Graham covers political and global news for The Atlantic, and he did a sort of forensic trace of the myth to better understand why it endures and joins us now to tell us what he found. David Graham, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So who first came up with this term, the Muslim no-go zones?
So as far as I can tell, the first example of this appearing anywhere is in a blog post by Daniel Pipes, who's a writer who writes a lot about radical Islam. And he suggested that there are these zones. This was back in 2006. What's interesting is he has since recanted, and he says, you know, when you go to these places, they're a little bit rough, but they're nothing that an American who'd been to the Bronx or Detroit wouldn't recognize. Mm. Still, despite that, the myth has endured and grown since then.
Well, it was brought up a lot after the Charlie Hebdo shootings and the standoff in Parisian Delhi that followed. Slapped down pretty quickly. But is there any truth to the claim that there are Muslim no-go zones in European cities, or America for that matter?
There's no such thing as a no-go zone that I have seen or that anybody else has proven. Now, there are some interesting facts that underlie it. So, for example, there are places where ad hoc Sharia squads are going around and trying to encourage people to dress more modestly or not drink alcohol. This is happening in Britain, among other places. There are slums in France that have been designated special zones. And there are places where the government is concerned about low education, low employment rates, low incomes, high rates of public housing. And so they've made a special emphasis there. Those are called special urban zones. Some people have equated these special urban zones with no-go zones, but they're really two different things. And in fact, they're areas the government is focusing on. There also you see stories about really atrocious anti-Semitic comments in certain neighborhoods and places in Western Europe. So you can see how all of these little strands combine to suggest that there are no-go zones. But as for an actual no-go zone, it's not really a thing.
You also wrote about some somewhat parallel legal systems operating in some places in Europe. Tell us about those.
Well, that's right. There are cases in Britain. Britain, this has been particularly controversial. There are family courts that run with, there are sort of Sharia family courts. So you can deal with divorce and other issues, domestic disputes through these courts. There are also systems, for many years there's been a Jewish court system. And this is a case where if both parties agree, rather than going into the secular legal system, you can adjudicate a dispute that way. People are upset about that. I mean, they say that it's the imposition of Sharia law. There are questions about whether these courts do enough to protect women's rights. But there's something that's been set up by the state and has existed for a while.
When I read about this, I thought about the semi-autonomous Orthodox Jewish communities in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, for example, or among the Amish, who that also have a sort of parallel legal system, at least in civil and familial and family cases. Is that a fair comparison?
I think that's a very fair comparison. I heard from people about Christian courts in the United States. You get similar courts in the U.S. where disputes can be resolved that way. So I think it's exactly the right comparison.
Well, I want to go back to this sensitive urban zone designation. There are, of course, areas surrounding Paris and neighborhoods in Marseille, for example, where you would not want to go, correct?
I guess it depends on the time of day and what you're doing. You know, they're rough neighborhoods. They're places that are poor and there are high crime rates. And often that has more to do with a coincidence with religion than with anything else. So they tend to be full of immigrants who are not as well educated and employment opportunities are not as great. It's not exactly a product of Islam. It's a product of poverty more than anything. And you see the French government making efforts to improve services there, to increase education, and really to renew those urban zones.
A similar question was put to Louisiana Governor and, we might add, potential presidential hopeful Bobby Jindal. Now, here he is speaking to CNN's Max Foster in London.
There are people here in London that will tell you there are neighborhoods where the women don't feel safe walking through those neighborhoods without veils. There are neighborhoods where the police are less likely to go. That's a dangerous thing.
You need to give me, to make an assertion like that, you need to give me the area so we can look at it, because I haven't heard of one.
Oh, well, look, I think your viewers know absolutely there are places where the police are less likely to go. They absolutely know there are neighborhoods where they wouldn't feel comfortable. They wouldn't feel comfortable with their
wives, their daughters, their
sisters.
Well, that's high crime rates, except that they feel uncomfortable. It's not because there are too many Muslims there.
Now, this was said after the Fox News apology, and Jindal has since not only refused to acknowledge an inaccuracy of the claim, but has actually doubled down on it. He reiterated it last week on Washington Week. So what's going on here? Why is this persisting with Bobby Jindal, at least?
Well, there are a couple things going on. I mean, I think Jindal is trying to position himself for a potential presidential run as somebody who would be tough on radical Islam and who would not tolerate this sort of thing. So that's the domestic political dimension. The other thing is that once these myths take root, they're very hard to get out. So sure, Fox News had these impressive apologies and was very clear about it. But of course, that's after a week of many viewers hearing the comments. If you repeat these things over and over, they're going to get ingrained. And so it's much easier to start a rumor than it is to debunk one effectively. And it's interesting when you see these myths spring up, particularly in ideological media. They just repeat and repeat and repeat, and you get a sort of echo chamber.
Do you think actually the Fox News apology may in some way have added fuel to the fire?
It's quite possible it has. There's very interesting political science research on this sort of psychology of myths. And one of the things that researchers have found is that sometimes debunking a statement actually increases people's belief in it. So if they have a sort of ideological connection to a statement, like the idea that there are Muslim no-go zones, and you tell them there aren't, they're skeptical of that statement, and it tends to really encourage their belief and redouble it.
So what happens with your article, David Graham? I mean, you look through the origins of this. You find some grains of truth that metastasize into this kind of a myth. Are you somehow underscoring it?
I worry that I am, yeah. I don't, and I think it's a difficult position because I want to be in a place where I'm telling people the truth, and I'm making clear that something that a major public figure and a person in a position of public trust is saying things that are not true and are mistakes. On the other hand, by repeating them and by giving them more oxygen, I'm only giving them more air. And by debunking them, I'm potentially giving people reason to believe that I'm part of a media conspiracy to cover these things up. Certainly the emails I've received since I wrote the article, some of them have suggested that.
Well, David Graham, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
David Graham is staff writer for The Atlantic, and you'll find a link to read his article, Why the No-Go Zone Myth Won't Die, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And when Word of Mouth continues, we'll tackle a very different kind of origin story, the humble and fascinating beginnings of Gatorade. That's after the break.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth. Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 50 years ago, if you were an athlete practicing or playing in the unforgiving heat, water breaks were unthinkable.
Well, did you ever hear of giving a hot, sweaty football player all the cold drink he wants? Never.
The belief was the longer you could stay off of anything, the better your performance would be.
And the longer you play without it, the tougher you are, and the tougher you are, the meaner you are, and the meaner you are, you'll be the better player.
So anybody that said, hey, coach, can I have a water break, was perceived to be a little bit less than tough.
It's a wonder we all didn't cramp up and die.
And there's a clip from a new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary called The Sweat Solution, which chronicles the history of Gatorade. The drink began as an experiment to help the Florida Gators football team stave off debilitating dehydration during practice. 50 years later, Gatorade is the largest, most successful non-carbonated beverage in the U.S. Neil Amdur is co-director of the documentary and joins us now with more. Neil, hello and welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's a delight to be with you this morning. Thank you.
So tell us about Robert Cade. He is the doctor who invented Gatorade. A little on his background.
Well, he is truly a Renaissance man, someone whose interests were as diverse as Studebakers, collecting Studebakers, playing the violin, growing flowers, and also just an excellent source of energy and enthusiasm for renal medicine, which he brought to the University of Florida when he came there in the early 60s. And he assembled a team of researchers, and in response to the Florida football team's need for solving this dilemma that they had of players going to the hospital with dehydration and loss of 20 pounds as much in a workout in the summer, Dr. Cade, this quirky little guy, decided to create a solution that has become and changed the whole face of sports training.
So how did he test it, and who did he test it on?
Well, what happened was, what was interesting, the coach at the time, Ray Graves, wouldn't allow Dr. Cade and his researchers to work with the varsity players, but he would allow them to experiment with the freshmen. So they literally bottled the sweat of the players who were in sweatsuits and gloves and to try to find out what was in the sweat that they could replenish. And after looking through it and deciding what they had to replace, they came up with a solution that initially tasted so bad that the players themselves really hated drinking it. It was Dr. Cade's wife, Mary, who had suggested changing the solution to a lemony kind of taste. And so what they did was they squeezed lemons one night and brought that solution back to the players. P.S., Gatorade as we know it.
It's just such a funny little clip in the film where his wife just says, add lemons.
Yeah, she's a terrifically interesting woman, and the daughter, Phoebe Cade Miles, who is now launched and has put into play the Cade Museum in Gainesville for research and development, is an extension of Dr. Cade's contributions to medicine.
Well, what is the secret to Gatorade? Why does it actually work?
I think probably the solution is that they came up with what actually was being lost in athletic performance. And water was not necessarily the most conducive in the sense that you tended to get heavy-weighted. And I think the Gatorade got through your system much faster so that the players could respond to that. And what happened was when they tried this with the varsity in 1966, the football team, not only did they have a Heisman Trophy winning quarterback in Steve Spurrier, but the team was winning these comebacks in the second half of football games, and people were astonished when they went 7-0, went to a national ranking, and how did they do this? And that's when I wrote the first story on Gatorade in 1966 for the Miami Herald.
Wow, so you were really early on this one.
I was covering the Florida football team, and some of the opponents were kind of startled at how the Gators looked so fresh in the fourth quarter, and I had gotten a lead when I was up there one weekend and talked to Dr. Cade, and he explained this to me, and I wrote the story in the Herald. And then, of course, what happened was one of the great mysteries, which is in the film, interestingly enough, somehow or another, when they went to play the University of Georgia in their rivalry in Jacksonville, the Gatorade never arrived for the game. and no one could figure out whether the truck that was sending it got hijacked, whether there was some other mysterious circumstances. But the players didn't have the Gatorade. P.S. They lost after leading at halftime. They were beaten badly 27-10. And that's when the myth of Gatorade continued to expand as to something that could improve athletic performance.
And Neil, did you try it way back then?
Oh, yeah. I was one of Dr. Cade's pupils, in a sense, because I wrote other stories about his involvement. He was also early on developed carbohydrate loading, which marathoners now do with pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Cade substituted steak for, he would put what he called Gator Go, which was a high carbohydrate pancake like breakfast for game day instead of steaks. And the players responded to that. And Gator Go became kind of legendary. And he fooled around with a hydraulic football helmet that he created, and he would have some of the players bang him on the head with a hammer to see whether it would help concussions. That was Dr. Cade, who was quite a remarkable Renaissance man, and I think has gotten the recognition now that he deserves over the years for his contributions.
We're talking with the veteran sports writer and editor Neil Amder about a film that he co-directed about the history and origins of Gatorade, truly a revolutionary drink in the world of sports. How did it make the jump from the Florida Gators football team to mass marketed to the general public for dehydration?
Interesting question, because in the film, Dr. Cade is quoted as saying that they never really made the drink for and never thought that they would be taking this to the general public. But I think when the word got out that Florida had this solution that was developed, what happened was Dr. Cade, who wanted it obviously to be something that would benefit, and interestingly enough, in the film as well, there's a segment when his daughter and a nurse talks about how Gatorade was being used at Chan's Hospital, a children's hospital in Gainesville, for newborn babies who were also suffering severe dehydration. And this is something that became instituted into the general medical practices in using Gatorade and that type of electrolyte solution to help with that. And I think what happened was other schools started to get the word out on Gatorade, and they started to develop it. And then they created a Gatorade Trust among the researchers there, sold the product initially to Stokely Van Camp, which began to market it, and subsequently it started to grow from there. And it has continued to grow over the years, and the statistics don't lie. I mean, in 2001, they had sold 339 million cases of Gatorade. Yeah. In 2013, which is the last year that they had it, they sold 632 million cases. So the increase is significant at a time when a lot of other of the sugary drinks are losing among health-conscious consumers. And here is Gatorade, which is continuing to show growth.
Well, we're talking about hydration all the time, not just for people who are engaged in sports, but it really is difficult to imagine a time when staying hydrated was not mandated for athletes.
I think it's definitely true. And I think part of what the evolution of these, a lot of the different sports training techniques developed, I mean, today it would be so much more difficult under NCAA regulations for a coach to authorize an experiment on a campus using football players as so-called guinea pigs in an experiment,
right,
keeping in mind this was 1965. But I think what is happening is that when you have visionaries who are able to see through these kinds of things and are able to see the benefits, you're seeing it in a lot of other areas as athletes become much more attuned to weight machines today than they were, let's say, back in the 60s when maybe they jog a little. Now everyone is into year-round conditioning, staying in shape. Much more weight training is done out of the season than it was done. And I think we're getting better athletes. We're getting more finely tuned. You're getting more women involved with marathons and training today than we've ever had before. And I think this is a sign that the public has become much more health conscious.
Well, you're also bringing up another point for me. I mean, when I was watching it, I couldn't help but think of Deflategate, right? It's going on now. And for the first time realizing, for me, I never thought about how an underinflated ball could make a huge difference. So 50 years ago, they didn't consider hydration. I'm thinking, Neil, you know, 50 years from now, are we going to hear about something that we wouldn't have thought of that's become the norm? You know, 50 years from now, are we going to hear, no, you're not supposed to stretch after working out?
I think it's evolving all the time. And a lot of times when you hear different training techniques that people are using and recommending, they'll tell you about, you know, running and its ills, let's say, versus some other cardio type, running on a Stairmaster or on an elliptical machine. People who are running, let's say, trying to run marathons, you know, 10 or 12 marathons, and then they wonder why they have a knee replacement or a hip replacement. I've never run a marathon. I've been running for 40 years, but I've run a couple of half marathons, and I'm still running today. And the great thing about it is that I think probably if I had been running marathons instead of reporting on them, I might have broken down myself. I would rather, in the long run, continue to have my healthy experience, at least as I go. And I think those are the fine lines that people draw up, and you have to figure out where your limits are.
Well, Neil Amter, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and best wishes to you, and stay warm up there.
Thank you. Neil Amter of Amter Productions, it's a multimedia company. He's also former sports editor for the New York Times. He co-directed, along with David Bailenson, ESPN's The Sweat Solution. It's the history of Gatorade. And you can find a link to watch the film at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from the alchemy of college sports into the classroom when Word of Mouth returns, the latest installment of our series on unusual college courses, The Uncommon Core. Today it's Zombies 101. That's after the news.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our series, The Uncommon Core, highlights offbeat college courses offered at colleges and universities across the country. Today, popular media through the lens of the undead.
Hi, my name is Brendan Riley. I'm an associate professor of English at Columbia College Chicago, where I teach writing and media studies and literature courses. I'm most well known for Zombies in Popular Media, a January session course I've been teaching since 2007.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Well, I like the philosophical questions the best. I find that that those questions get most quickly to the things that students are concerned with. And so the zombie movies that really challenge us to think about how we react to other people and what it means to be part of a community are really useful.
If we start letting people in here, we're going to let the wrong ones in, and then I'm dead. And you know what? I don't want to die.
We're the wrong ones.
Nobody here is sick, and I intend on...
In that regard, I like Invasion of the Body Snatchers quite a bit. We'll use a Showtime movie from 2006 called Zombie Honeymoon, which is really great. The production values aren't fantastic, but the movie has a lot of meat to chew on, so to speak.
Please, I don't know what's happening, but you gotta believe me. You gotta believe me. Please.
How do I know you're not gonna kill me, Danny?
Because I love you.
I've developed a system to warn students about the vigors of the class. Basically, I have this long email that says, "Welcome to the class. Are you sure you want to take it? It's really hard," which one of my students characterized as the go-away email. You know, I don't see it that way so much as making sure that when they get there, they know it's not just watching a movie every day and talking for a few minutes, but rather it's a semester's worth of work in 3 weeks. I like to think that zombies have hit a sort of zenith since the mid-2000s that they hadn't gotten to yet in terms of being a figure that will be perennially available in the way that vampires are. They've hit a kind of cultural zeitgeist where really anyone you talk to can tell you a couple things about how zombies work, and that's going to keep them in the conversation in a way that they haven't been before that. As to how long I'm going to teach the class, you know, as long as I'm continuing to enjoy teaching it and there are new zombie texts to explore, I can't see myself stopping anytime soon.
The Uncommon Core is produced by Word of Mouth's Taylor Quimby. As New Englanders found themselves practically buried in snow this week, we were reminded of one of the scariest blizzard scenes in film history, the hedge maze chase scene from Stanley Kubrick's 1980 adaptation of The Shining. Well, you could soon get a chance to wander a maze inspired by that scene, or even design one yourself. The historic Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, is holding a contest for students and architects alike to design a topiary maze that will welcome visitors from all over the globe.
We've received mazes that draw their inspiration from the history of the hotel, from Kubrick's film, from Stephen King's novel, all sorts of other sources.
That was Jeremy Spates, history and architecture director at the Stanley Hotel, which has always had a special relationship with Stephen King's novel, The Shining.
Well, in 1974, Stephen King spent one night here in the hotel. He was driving to Granby with his family, but the road was closed, so he had to spend the night here. Being the macabre sort of person Stephen King was, he saw the hotel up on the hill, looking rather dilapidated. We were going through bankruptcy proceedings in 1970, and he said, "That's where we're spending the night.
Mouse come out, wherever you are."
That one night, as you may have guessed, is exactly what inspired King's now classic horror novel. King's biggest fans may already know that the Stanley Hotel never actually had a hedge maze, nor did the Overlook Hotel in the book, by the way. But Jeremy says it does have its fair share of ghost stories.
In reality, we believe that the hotel is haunted. We do ghost tours. We do paranormal investigations. We've had ghost hunters and ghost adventures here. But we don't believe that there are any ominous spirits. We don't think the hotel is evil. But we do really sort of capitalize on that horror genre.
Now, if you think you've got what it takes to design a killer hedge maze, you can find instructions on how to enter the contest on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Just remember, all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. So be sure to take a break every now and again.
Here's Johnny!
Stick around for more Word of Mouth when we return. Millennials, they're often called the young invincibles. Well, we're going to hear from one who argues that her generation is inadequately prepared to deal with the loss of loved ones. We're going to find out why when Word of Mouth returns.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. America's 76 million baby boomers are losing 4,900 of their parents every day. And in typical boomer-centric fashion, have created new language and rituals for talking about and dealing with death. It's just one more thing that sets baby boomers apart from the good-looking millennial demographic that they often disparage for being immature or interminably carefree. But millennials lose their parents, too. Emily Kaiser did, and she found few people her age to talk about or to even comprehend what it felt like to lose her mother. Her piece for Washingtonian Magazine called When Millennials Mourn generated dozens of comments from across the age spectrum. And Emily Kaiser, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm so sorry for your loss, first of all. When did your mother die?
January 27th, 2013, so 2 years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry. How old were you when she passed?
I was 26, almost 27.
Now, you write about sinking into a profound gloom for about 6 months after she passed. But long before that, of course, you had to go back to work as a producer at Minnesota Public Radio. How did your colleagues respond?
Well, I came back. I took a number of weeks off, both from when she went into hospice and then also when after she passed and with funeral planning and whatnot. And it, for the most part, just felt that people either didn't know or, you know, had kind of moved on, that, you know, this was something that was so a part of my life at that point. And it was something that I was constantly thinking about. But, you know, on their end, you know, we had so many people, you know, boomers in particular, that we're losing parents all the time, and this was kind of a common occurrence at our workplace. So when I came back, it was kind of like how they treated everyone else who had lost a parent, and I felt at that point that my loss was so much greater and so much more intense that I was kind of expecting a different reaction when I got back.
How about your friends, people your own age?
They were very supportive. They were, you know, they did everything that they could, but none of them had lost parents yet, and so, you know, even a lot of them hadn't lost many grandparents, maybe a couple, and so they just didn't know how to react, and I don't think they understood how intense the grief was going to be and for how long.
That's so interesting because I think of the millennials as the generation that's most associated with the Victorian age, you know, fixated on death and mourning, their mustaches, the taxidermy, steampunk fashions and art. What do you think is behind that?
I think there's kind of a, I don't know how you would call it, but kind of a fascination with death in some sense. But I don't think that we're very connected to it. I think that's kind of where that fascination comes from, because now I kind of cringe a little bit at some of the grotesque or the weird ways that people look at death versus kind of how that all changes once you've actually gone through losing someone that, you know, you can't imagine living without.
So you sort of stumbled around in your own fog for a while, and you were resistant, but you did finally join a support group where you met a couple of other women in their 20s. And you write about sharing not grief, but venting. What were you venting about?
I think we all had so much anger after the death of our parents. And so the four of us were all in our 20s, and we all had lost parents within the last, I think the longest out one was about a year and a half. And so there was just a lot of pent-up anger about how people reacted to the death, how we were supposed to go on with our lives. We felt, you know, so betrayed and, like, things were so unfair that we were having to go through this and that people didn't get it. It was just thinking about our futures and looking at those big milestones and trying to figure out where all of those fit into kind of our long-term plan. And I think on the bigger end, too, we had a lot of frustration about trying to figure out where, you know, the way that we talked about it was looking at it as like a baby mobile and how one piece of that mobile had fallen off and was gone. And we were trying to rebalance our, you know, central family unit. So our siblings and our parents, and trying to figure out how to help our parents mourn, you know, our surviving parent, and also be there for our siblings, but also grieve on our own and kind of figure out where all of those different pieces needed to go to make that work.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting metaphor. But I want to get to these kind of milestones that you were talking about. I mean, by the time your mother was your age, she was probably married and with kids. Is that right?
Yep.
So something that you and many in your cohort, I'll say, have put off, which has made the parental-child relationship that much stronger. You looked into some theories on that. What did you find?
Well, I looked at a lot of the information about, you know, when people got married, when they had children, you know, and the average age for marriage is 29 for men and 27 for women, and the average age for the first birth of a college graduate has now risen up to age 30. So looking back on other generations, I found a lot of research about that 36% of Generation X was already married by the time they were between the ages of 18 and 32, 48% of baby boomers, and 65% of the silent generation. So there was a major change happening in how we were delaying some of those milestones, and partially because of the economy and partially just because our parents made more of an effort to stay close to us and be more involved in our lives. We just end up being, in a lot of ways, much closer to our parents than other generations, financially and personally. And so I think we all just kind of expect that our parents are going to be around for all of those big events in our lives. And I think that was a big part of it, too, was mourning this loss that my mom wouldn't be able to be part of those events and how much she was looking forward to being a grandma and being there when I hit all these huge, you know, career milestones or getting my first house. And that, you know, I was mourning the fact that she wouldn't get to be part of that either.
Mm. Well, at the risk of being like one of those people that you talk to at work, I am older than you, and I just lost my dad just before Thanksgiving, so it's still very, very fresh to me. And it was sudden. He had a catastrophic cerebral hemorrhage. But he was 91, and he did have a full and rich life, and that's what a lot of people reminded me of. Well, he had a good run, you know, kind of thing. But still, he was my dad. I mean, I think many people just don't know what to say after someone dies. Do you really think it's generational?
I think on that end, it is in some ways. I think that I can imagine it's catastrophic whenever you lose a parent. You know, they are the people in your life that love you more than anybody else and will always be there for you. And it's, I've come to see now as I have gone through my grief and kind of gotten a little bit away from it, that, you know, this is a major thing for a lot of people, no matter what age, and it's never fair that they have died. But for our, I think it's more about looking at the differences on what we're mourning that changes how the generations are looking at it, in the sense that I, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, how am I going to have kids without my mom there? You know, how is, I want to have her, you know, at my house those first days after I have a kid, or, you know, I want her to be at my wedding and to be able to celebrate that with me when I find someone that I want to spend the rest of my life with. And so we're kind of mourning different things, because on some level, I still really did need my parents in a different way than generations now are helping take care of their parents as they age.
I'm speaking with Emily Kaiser about her article for Washingtonian Magazine called When Millennials Mourn. The article struck a nerve for a lot of people who also lost their young parents when they themselves were young. But a number of commenters accused you of being ageist, triggered largely, I think, by this line: I couldn't be expected to feel sorry for a bunch of 50-year-olds. People felt that you showed little empathy and that, like millennials are sometimes accused of, you were being all about yourself. You know, you think people should notice your feelings or validate you. So what's your response to those comments?
Yeah, I did get a lot of responses like that. I mean, the overall, the vast majority of what I received were people my age who thanked me and said that, you know, I told their story and they were feeling these same things and weren't able to articulate them. But those people that did come out and kind of lash back at me a little bit with the ageist comment, I think, like what I mentioned earlier about just the idea that we're mourning different things and that there's no way to understand what anyone goes through with a loss. They're all very different. But to think back on what it would be like to go through those major life events without your parents there. You know, I was talking to my mom on the phone every day. Mm-hmm. She was a huge part of my life still, and I hadn't, you know, moved on into creating kind of my own family setup yet. I didn't have, you know, kids or anything that would give me kind of my own family unit that I could be focused on. Mm. This was still my core family. And I think for a lot of people, it's just hard to understand being my age and having to face those sorts of things.
So just 2 years after the loss, have you thought about how you're going to cope with, you know, filling in that gap and those milestones, your wedding, your first child? I mean, have you thought about how to bring her into those in some kind of way?
In a lot of ways, I'm just kind of delaying it a lot of ways, just to, I don't quite want to think about it yet, just because it is a little too much to kind of take in. And if I step back too far and start thinking ahead how much of my life, you know, hopefully is left without her there, it can get really overwhelming to think about. So I think there will be ways that I will incorporate her and her memory into all of those events. And I'm hopeful that I have enough wonderful women, aunts and, you know, friends and friends of my mom even that have kind of reached out and have been telling me that they, you know, will be there for me in those kind of situations. And that's really comforting. And I think the biggest thing for me is that all of these people have so many stories and so many experiences with my mom that I didn't have. And so I'm able to kind of keep her alive by learning all these new stories about her and how she was as a mother and how she was at these points in my life that I don't remember.
Well, that's a beautiful thought, Emily. Really the best, all the best to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Emily Kaiser is associate digital producer for The Daily Circuit on NPR. There's a link to read her piece for Washingtonian Magazine. It's called When Millennials Mourn, and that's at wordofmouthradio.org. For many people, the very thought of death provokes feelings of anxiety and helplessness and dread. But one woodworker in Maine has an interesting way to help his clients prepare for the inevitable. Julie Lowry brings us his story.
Nice to see you again. You're doing well?
I'm doing very well. I'm not ready.
This is Ginny Landry and Chuck Lakin. They met 4 years ago after she read an article in the Waterville Sentinel.
Oh, I remember, Chuck. I said, you're the answer to my prayer. I've always wanted to go out in a pine box, Chuck. Can you make me one? And when I told you I was 4 feet 11 inches tall, you said it won't be a big job. I said, I want a coffin, and can you make it into a quilt rack? And he said, I can make it into anything you want. So he did.
This quilt rack slash coffin sits right at the top of the stairs in the hallway.
Whenever I have guests here and the conversation lags a bit or things get a little boring, I say, would you like to see my coffin?
So Ginny Landry isn't dying. She isn't sick. In fact, she's a rather spry 81-year-old woman. But yes, she has a coffin. And Chuck Lakin made it for her because, well, that's what he does. He makes coffins for living people. Which might not be as weird as it seems. To understand, we need to go back to 1979 and the death of Chuck's father, who had lung cancer that spread to his brain. He was at home for the last 6 weeks of his life.
I was there for that last month of that.
And he died in his own bed with his wife and four kids touching him.
And it had been a really personal experience up to that point. And I wanted to be a part of whatever happened next, but I didn't know what I could do. And so we called the funeral director, who did what he thought we wanted him to do, which was he arrived promptly, zipped him in a body bag, hauled him away, and 4 days later we got a box of ashes in the mail.
Chuck felt that standard funeral approach was impersonal, and it continued to bother him. And it took him about 20 years, but eventually he came upon a guide for home funerals. And he learned that you can keep the body at home. You can bathe, dress, and care for it yourself. You can do the service at home if you want. And it's what he wishes he could have done for his father. So he begins spreading the word about home funerals.
Now, I'm a woodworker, and if you talk about home funerals, I mean, what else would you mean? You'd certainly try it.
And so began Chuck's unusual hobby. On a recent Monday morning, Chuck is in his basement woodshop, hammering away at a simple pine coffin. Around the workshop are coffins of all shapes and styles.
This is the bookcase coffin. This is the three-way, or the entertainment center coffin. That's a version of the quick coffin. So this is that flared coffin.
These are not coffins like we're used to seeing in funeral homes. These are simple pine boxes with clever designs that Chuck dreams up.
It's one of those things that I often wake up in the middle of the night and don't go back to sleep readily. And I do some of my best design work then. And the three-way coffin, the display cabinet entertainment center storage chest coffin was a design that came to me in the middle of the night once.
Not sure you want your TV in your coffin? That's okay. Chuck will make your coffin however you want it. In fact, each coffin is custom made.
Almost never does somebody just come in and said, well, I like that one, make me one of those. And hand me a check and ask me when I'll deliver it. That doesn't happen. There's always a conversation involved.
Picking out a coffin is about as personal as you can get. It forces Chuck's customers to ask themselves what they really want to happen when they die. Ginny already knew she didn't want to be embalmed.
I hate that. It's so artificial. It's a way of not accepting that someone has died. We're going to get them all gussied up and they're going to look pretty and people are going to say, oh, she looks good. She's dead. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with being dead. It happens to everybody.
So Chuck helped design a coffin that respected Ginny's desire for something more simple.
When I'm dead, I'm going to be in that pine box and they're going to carry me over the hill and warm up the world a little bit.
It puts Chuck in the unique position of helping people have the experience with death that they want. Last month, Chuck spoke to an adult ed class at Coney High School in Augusta. Chuck's lectures about home funerals include a discussion about all of our options when we die.
You know, so what I'm really trying to do, what it's evolved into, is I'm trying to get people to think and talk about their own death.
And this is where buying a coffin before you need it starts to make a lot more sense. We're all going to die. Chuck just wants us to admit it and prepare for it.
Having made the preparations in advance makes things a lot simpler on the survivors. Just they don't have to go through the process of trying to figure out how many different bank accounts you have or where your investments are or where are the deeds, where's the title to the car, or what do you want to have happen to your body after your death.
Death is a natural part of life. There's no avoiding it. But most people aren't comfortable talking about their own mortality, and Chuck is doing his best to try to reach them.
Now I'm merely trying to change the way the American public thinks about death. Ignoring the fact that you're going to die, or fighting the fact that you're going to die, takes away from some of the possibilities of the experience. I think that the opposite of death isn't life. I think the opposite of death is birth. It's a transition into life, and it's a transition out of life.
It's a transition that none of us look forward to, but Chuck feels that if we take steps to prepare for death, we'll be less frightened of it when it comes. For Salt Radio, I'm Julia Lowry Henderson.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you like what you heard, there is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can always catch the show in its entirety when you subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find a link to our podcast on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or by searching for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. If you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. We'll be right back.